Please be seated. This is case number 50057, Edward Thomas Wilson v. State of Nevada. If the parties are ready, please proceed.
Your Honor, Doug Mitchell, on behalf of the petitioner, Edward Thomas Wilson, with me also is Glenn Cartledge, who is co-counsel. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I could, please. Your Honor, this morning I represent...
Could you speak up, counsel? I'm sorry.
Certainly, I will do
that. A little trouble hearing you.
Sometimes I speak too soft and sometimes I speak too loud, so I'll try to be a little louder today.
Thank you.
Your Honors, in our opening brief, we have set forth a number of grounds upon which we think that the petition for Mr. Wilson to set
us... Counsel, if I could have you stop, I thought we could go ahead. We're missing our clerk, which affects our time. And even though we can record it all, we just can't time it.
Good call, Chief.
Yeah.
Here she is.
And as much as I know you would like to have unlimited time,
we can always find a way to fill it.
Okay.
We're aware of that. We good?
Ready? All right. Once again, Your Honors, in our opening and our reply briefs, we have set forth a number of grounds which justify setting aside Mr. Wilson's conviction for capital murder in 1979. This morning, I would like to focus on just a few of those grounds, but all of the grounds set forth in the opening brief and the reply brief justify setting aside Mr. Wilson's conviction and justify sending this case back for a new trial, both on the guilt phase and also, at least at a minimum, on a penalty phase or a resentencing. But let me focus first on the primary issue, which is this, that all of the aggravating circumstances which were used to justify the imposition of capital punishment against Mr. Wilson are invalid. And they have been invalidated by subsequent decisions of this court, which are retroactive in their application and which afford relief to Mr. Wilson. First, Mr. Wilson was found to have three aggravating circumstances: kidnapping, robbery, and pecuniary gain, or receiving something of value. The kidnapping and robbery aggravating circumstances have both been invalidated by this court's decision in McConnell. In McConnell, this court very clearly stated that it is improper for a prosecution to base a capital sentence using the felony aggravators, which also formed the predicates for a felony murder conviction. In this case, the indictment that charged Mr. Wilson charged him with two felony predicates. One was robbery, and the other one was kidnapping. The aggravating circumstances that were found by the three-judge panel during the phase included robbery and kidnapping, without any deviation or variance in evidence or proof. Under McConnell, therefore, those two aggravating circumstances have been rendered invalid. And as this court has recognized in Bayrano, McConnell is retroactive in its application. And therefore, those two aggravating circumstances are no longer valid, and they can't be used to justify his capital punishment sentence.
Counsel, as we go down that road, though, what are we to do with the fact that this case should be procedurally barred?
Well, the claims involving his aggravating circumstances are not procedurally barred, Your Honor. He raised these issues in his direct appeal, and they have been raised in the post-conviction proceedings since that time. They were properly preserved, they were properly raised, and in fact, they were rejected by the Supreme Court in his direct appeal because it was a case that had preceded McConnell and preceded Bayrano. So there is no procedural default, and as this court has recognized in prior decisions, when an aggravating circumstance has been invalidated by a subsequent decision of the Supreme Court, that aggravating circumstance is retroactively applicable.
This is a little unique because he pled guilty.
He did.
And was he charged with felony murder and premeditated murder?
He was charged. The indictment charges him with both premeditated murder and felony murder.
Okay. Now when he pleads guilty, does he admit that he killed this undercover officer with premeditation, deliberation, knowingly and willingly?
He does not, Your Honor. In fact, the plea...
Tell me about the plea of guilty.
Pardon me?
Tell me about his plea, what he said.
The plea colloquy is, I think, reasonably clear that this case is based almost wholly, or his plea is based wholly on the notion of the felony murder. If you go through his plea colloquy, Judge Brennan asks Mr. Wilson if he understands the definition of premeditated murder. And Mr. Wilson explains his understanding of the definition of premeditated murder. Judge Brennan never asks Mr. Wilson whether, in fact, that is what occurred in his case, whether there was any premeditation or planning. He merely asked him if he understood the definition. The judge then asked Mr. Wilson's attorney, Mr. Brennan, whether or not he was to state the factual basis for the plea. And Mr. Brennan then recited the factual basis of the plea. The recitation of his factual basis was that the murder took place during the course of a robbery. And later on, Mr. Brennan reiterated that the murder took place during the course of a robbery, and that is all. They weren't pleading to anything else. After Mr. Brennan had laid out the factual predicate for Mr. Wilson's plea, Judge Breen asked Mr. Wilson if he understood what Mr. Brennan had just said and if that's in fact what happened, and Mr. Wilson said yes. Then Ms. Judge Breen went through a list of potential defenses that were available to Mr. Wilson, and in the course of that colloquy, Mr. Wilson stated fairly clearly that he felt the actions which resulted in Mr. Hoff's death were a product of self-defense, that it had only happened because Mr. Hoff had jumped him and that he was scared for his life, and as a result, a co-defendant, Mr. Laney, had come out and stabbed Officer Hoff. And Mr. Wilson said he thought it was self-defense, and he thought it wouldn't have happened. The death wouldn't have happened but for what Mr. Hoff had done. Now, as the plea colloquy proceeds, Mr. Dunlop, the prosecutor, understands that Mr. Wilson has not pled guilty to premeditation. And in fact, he attempts to persuade the judge to canvass Mr. Wilson about the idea that he was also pleading to premeditation merely because the indictment alleged both premeditation and felony murder. And as he did so, Mr. Brennan reiterated this Caslan instruction that is part of our opening brief and has been discussed by this court before in NECA. And the fact that, well, premeditation can be as simple as two successive thoughts of the mind that could be instantaneous. I've explained that to Mr. Wilson. But then he goes on and says, but, Your Honor, if we're talking about any notion of planning, anything where there was any real forethought, no, we don't agree to that. We're only here on the notion that this murder took place during the course of a robbery. Nowhere in the plea colloquy does Mr. Wilson ever state that he acted with premeditation or with deliberation or with any sort of thought to kill Officer Hoff. There is nothing in the record that suggests that. All we have in the record that suggests there is any basis at all for concluding that this conviction rests on some notion of premeditation is the fact that the indictment alleges it as a compound with felony murder and premeditation, and the fact that Mr. Wilson stated that he understood what the definition of premeditation was.
Did the judge define transfer of intent and felony murder? Did you go into that?
There was a discussion about the notion of felony murder in the context of his attorney, Mr. Brennan, explaining how self-defense during the course of a robbery may still result in a felony murder conviction. And Mr. Wilson explained that he understood that because Mr. Hoff had been killed during the course of a robbery, that there was, in fact, a felony murder. But what we are missing is anything that really suggests this case was soundly based on premeditation, that his plea was soundly based on a notion of a deliberate, thoughtful, premeditated act. It's not there. And in that respect, Mr. Wilson's case is significantly different from Mr. McConnell's case, in which Mr. McConnell very clearly stated that his actions had been cold-blooded, premeditated murder, and in other testimony had laid out, in fact, all of the things that he did to plan this and think about this and stew on it before he finally undertook the act to kill.
How does Sawyer versus Whitley come into play here in this case? The Sawyer United States Supreme Court case that you cited in your brief.
Well, Your Honor, I think where we end up with this is back at the very foundational notion that in order for somebody to be convicted and plead guilty, they need to understand the nature and the consequences of exactly what they're pleading guilty to. And here, all we really see from this transcript and this plea colloquy is that the facts that Mr. Wilson understands he's pleading guilty to are those that relate to felony murder. He's never be really advised about, never given notice of, and never really told that, well, no, you're actually pleading to something else. In fact, his attorney, Mr. Brennan, at one point during the plea colloquy says, well, you know, really, Your Honor, once we've pled to felony murder, that's all that matters. At that point in time, the death penalty is available, and we don't need to go beyond that. And that's where we are. We're in a situation where Mr. Wilson is not told that he is pleading to premeditated murder. In fact, he is told, really, he's there to plead to felony murder. And everything he says, everything that takes place during that plea colloquy, shows that he's pleading to felony murder, that's the thrust of what he's doing. And we have one of those situations where this McConnell court said that if you have a conviction that rests in whole or in part on felony murder, then you cannot use those felony aggravators to justify the death sentence. And that's exactly what we have here. Notwithstanding the fact that this is a plea, we have a situation where the conviction, the capital sentence, rests on felony aggravators, which were part of the predicates used to justify first-degree murder in the first place.
And you said he raised this issue when he did a direct appeal?
He did, Your Honor. In fact,
I know there was a case, I had some murder cases in 1980, where there was a case called Cherry versus North Carolina, which was the, you know, no one dreamed that this court would come up with McConnell. And we raised that in cases, but it was never accepted in the trial courts in Clark County.
And in fact, the Nevada Supreme Court in Wilson's initial direct appeal cited Cherry versus North Carolina and said, you know, we don't have to get there because the plea agreement, the plea and the indictment also include a premeditation component. So it says because the indictment alleged premeditation and because he pled to the indictment, this is premeditated murder and felony murder. And consequently, we don't have to decide whether you can use the felony predicates as aggravators. McConnell has now made that decision necessary. And Your Honor, my time right now is up, but we would ask the court to set aside Mr. Wilson's death sentence.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Gary Hattelstead from the Washoe County DA's office, appearing on behalf of the state. I will go ahead and focus on the one argument that was made here today, and if there's any other questions about the second issue that was posted on the website, I'll be happy to do that. But I just want to read one part of the transcript transcript, I think, was overlooked. I'm sure it was an accident. In the plea canvas on page 10 of October 3rd, Judge Breen is canvassing Mr. Wilson on what he did. And he's asking him what his part was, and Wilson said, "I started the whole thing." "Was it your idea?" "No, it wasn't my idea, but I started the whole thing." And then earlier, he points out in a question, "The crime is murder. One of the elements is premeditation of this offense. Do you know what that means?" And he says, "Yes." "What does it mean?" "We pre-planned it." I think that was probably overlooked by counsel in his argument. The next questions deal with specific intent. There's also questioning about deliberation and malice. The Nevada Supreme Court in this case, and we might as well call it Wilson 1 in 1983, said that Wilson pleaded guilty to premeditated murder and felony murder. Today we're told that he didn't do that. I think the record belies that claim. The essence of the argument today is because Mr. Wilson didn't make the same kinds of factual admissions that the federal court requires, that somehow undermines the validity of the plea. That's not the law in Nevada. The law in Nevada is to canvass the defendant on all the elements of the offense, personally address them, make sure they understand them. If they make factual admissions along with that, that serves to bolster the validity, the knowing, voluntary, and intelligent nature of the plea, but it is not a requirement. Mr. Wilson was advised of all the elements, of all theories, of all crimes, and he pleaded guilty to that. That's why this court in 1983 said he pleaded guilty to premeditated and deliberated murder. So that brings us to the question about McConnell. And this court has been very indulgent of me, maybe even overindulgent of me, to ask you to overrule McConnell. You gave me a long time in the Bejarno case years ago. I couldn't convince you then. I'm hoping maybe I can convince you today because this is a plea. And in McConnell 3, the court pointed out, we have never taken a position on a unanimous verdict of premeditated murder and a unanimous verdict on felony murder. That's essentially what a plea is. There's no difference between the two. And so the distinction that was drawn today about McConnell is, hey, McConnell made admissions during his plea canvass. But in McConnell 3, the court pointed out there were admissions plus the penalty hearing. Now, it will be disputed, and I'll be criticized for it later, but there's overwhelming evidence of premeditation and deliberation in this case. This court has said so on at least two other occasions, first in 1983, and then after the first post-conviction proceeding in the late 1980s. So that's the law of the case. We really can't change the facts. We can argue and parse the facts, perhaps, but when this court says there's overwhelming evidence of premeditation and deliberation, that is the case.
Oh, I am bothered by the fact that it's a plea, a guilty. I think, you know, I see the difference between the jury, which you don't know if it's felony murder or premeditation because there's no special verdict, as opposed to this, especially with attorneys going over all the police reports and everything with the client. And then if, in fact, you're correct, and do you know what premeditation means, pre-planning? I mean,
right. I mean, and the way I look at, I mean, McConnell has that substantive element about, you know, the interpretation of Lowenfield, which I still disagree with the court on that. But the other part of McConnell that's important is that procedural aspect of application here. You know, we talk about special verdict forms, and to the extent that we have a special verdict form in a plea canvas, we have the advisement of the elements and understanding of every element. I don't know if that's similar, analogous, however we might want to describe it. But the fact of the matter is the court has never said, especially in a plea case, that you can't have both, especially when you have overwhelming evidence presented in a penalty hearing, as was the case in McConnell, as was the case here. So I'm not going to take up much of my time, if any, unless you want to revisit the merits of McConnell. I'm happy to discuss it, whether or not the court misread Lowenfield and so forth. I'm happy to do that. I still think the court misinterpreted Lowenfield. I probably will for a long time. But for the purposes of a 15-minute argument today, I think you ought to draw a limit on it and say that when it comes to a plea like this, the analysis is different and should be. Now, let me just say a few other things about the nature of the plea itself. There seemed to be a suggestion that maybe Mr. Dunlap manipulated the process by reminding Mr. Wilson that he was pleading to all of the charges in the indictment, which is the case. He wanted to parse out some of these things about the self-defense. He indicated that I felt it was somewhat like self-defense because I was attacked after Mr. Hoff had attacked Lanny. But he was canvassed on the nature of self-defense and told in the plea canvass, self-defense doesn't apply if you're the initial aggressor or set a crime upon someone and they defend themselves. I guess it's self-defense when the murder victim doesn't lay down and die. The murder victim in this case fought back. There's nothing that creates a substantive defense to the charge of murder or any crime like this of self-defense. That understanding in his mind was changed through further canvassing by Judge Breen. That he was pleading to anything else other than felony murder, I dispute that as well. The indication in the record was, as they're discussing these theories of murder, Mr. Brennan did not want his client to admit to kidnapping as a theory of murder because there is still a writ pending, and a judicial admission would be used by the state if he pleaded guilty to that. That's where this issue came up. And Dunlap says, all right, fine, I won't use your statement as a judicial admission of the kidnapping and the penalty hearing. I will prove it. And then if you read the transcript where he's talking about premeditation and deliberation, he says something to the effect of, as far as that is concerned, it's the same with the kidnapping. So take that into conjunction with the statement that I read to you about it, understanding it's pre-planned. I don't see how this could possibly undermine the validity of this plea. It's a plea to both theories of murder.
Mr. Hattelstedt, moving to a separate subject, let's assume, for example, that the court said we're going to not extend McConnell to guilty pleas. There is still an argument in this case that Wilson is actually innocent of death eligibility.
Right.
And I'd like you to address the Ninth Circuit's order or opinion and later withdrawn in Deutscher, if I pronounce that correctly, concerning the application of the actual innocence exception in the context of a procedural bar.
All right. The way I will understand the argument is this. Actual innocence of the death penalty will depend on a showing by the petitioner that he is ineligible for the death sentence. So that begs the question, what does eligibility for the death penalty in Nevada mean? Is that what you had in mind?
Yes.
Okay.
The Ninth Circuit in...
Right.
Deutscher talked about the fact that in weighing states, which we are, that the failure of trial counsel, to have advanced mitigation evidence in the weighing process would fit within the actual innocence exception in Sawyer. That's what I'd like you to address.
Well, that invites a couple of questions. First of all, let me back up just one step. It would become an issue of whether or not the balance of aggravation and mitigation is part of the eligibility inquiry, first of all. The second difficulty, which I think might be unique to this case, is virtually all of the mitigating circumstances listed in this petition that we're here on was listed in the petition filed in 1993. That petition was procedurally barred and affirmed on appeal. So there is a procedural problem in this case, for sure. In the abstract, we could say that if there's a brand new amount of overwhelming mitigation sufficient to outweigh the aggravation, then we're on the trail of an actual innocence claim under Sawyer. But that just begs the question. I mean, is the first petition... Well, actually, the second petition in this case that culminated in Wilson 3 that was affirmed. Is there a procedural bar there? It seems to me that's the case. Otherwise, actual innocence in this case could go on ad infinitum. We could simply add two or three more new mitigating circumstances and then revisit our actual innocence claim again. And it's important in this case because it's the same stuff. The stuff that we find in the 2005 petition is identical to the material found in the 1993 petition. Ms. Cartlidge wrote both of these petitions. They rely on the same expert summaries. It's very similar. So I think there's a significant procedural bar here. The other problem becomes the eligibility issue, which you pointed out from the Dutcher case, and it's brought into a fine point by virtue of the recent Harrison cases. And then we look at McConnell 3 again about whether or not we have to show beyond a reasonable doubt whether mitigation and aggravation outweigh one another, depending on how it's phrased. And then we look at McConnell, and you point out the plain language of the statutes. We've never held that this was part of the eligibility inquiry, which takes it outside of Sawyer and Dutcher. So we would be left with the Johnson case that talks about their two eligibility conditions. But frankly, when you read Johnson carefully, that all appears to be dicta. And every other case that has examined this, and I tried to survey all the cases I could, it's explicitly rejected in McConnell, explicitly rejected in DePasquale in 1991, and explicitly rejected by Ybarra in 1984. Then we have Holloway, Gallego, Leslie, Servin, Witter, and Middleton, and none of those cases take a position on anything other than aggravation beyond a reasonable doubt. So the idea that Sawyer may raise a significant question here in light of mitigating evidence not presented to the trier of fact, we have not only a procedural problem, but we have a substantive problem about the nature of Nevada law. So my answer is the claim is procedurally barred. And to the extent that it isn't procedurally barred, the analysis of new mitigating evidence is outside the eligibility question. The only eligibility question is whether the aggravator or aggravators were proven beyond a reasonable doubt. That's the narrowing function, and that occurred here. Well, I have 2 minutes or so left, and I don't have any other further comments, at least on the argued issues. If there's a question or two, I'd be very happy to go ahead and answer it.
Mr. Hattelstedt, in all the cases you kind of rattled off, Middleton and all the others, is Wilson the only guilty plea case of that
yes.
whole group?
Okay. McConnell, well yeah. You know, save and except for McConnell. The other ones were all trials. And then the question became, you know, did the trial judge err and failing to give the instruction to prove the discretionary weighing factor beyond a reasonable doubt? And, you know, the court either didn't address it because it wasn't necessary or simply looked at the nature of the aggravating circumstance. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let me first address Mr. Hattelstedt's discussion about whether or not Mr. Wilson pled guilty to premeditated murder. I think if we look at the plea colloquy, the very provision that he looked at, he sort of took a lot of things out of sequence. But if we look at the true sequence with what happened between Judge Breen and Mr. Wilson, we'll see that what Breen did was on page... I guess this one doesn't have it. It's the appendix, page 3316. Judge Breen basically said, one of the elements is premeditation. Do you know what that means? And Mr. Wilson said, yes. And Judge Breen said, well, what is that? He says, we pre-planned it, the specific intent to kill somebody, right? And Wilson said, yes. And he's saying, what's the definition? Just as we had discussed earlier. Tell me what it means. And Mr. Wilson explained that he understood what the term meant. But then the very next thing that happens is Judge Breen says, Mr. Brennan, would you make a statement about the elements of this offense and what you explained to your client? And Mr. Brennan then begins, yes, Your Honor. I explained to him that the state would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, as you have explained to him also, in front of a jury, which is that in Washoe County, at the place alleged, which was near Idlewood Park on June the 25th,
that Mr. Wilson, with the assistance or help of the other three defendants during the course of an attempted robbery or robbery of Officer James Hoff, who was a Reno police officer and a human being, killed him by stabbing him to death with knives. And then Judge Breen said, is that the way you understand it? Defendant Wilson said, yes, Your Honor. The court, you're clear on that. Defendant Wilson, yes, Your Honor. Are you guilty of this offense? Yes, Your Honor. And then we go through, the rest of the colloquy is focusing on just that explanation.
But there is a section in here that the court says, you realize that when you enter a guilty plea, it is the equivalent of an admission of all the facts, all the elements of the charges, both the robbery and the murder. And do you understand that? It is an admission of these elements. And Wilson says, well, I admit the murder and the robbery, but knowing that it was a police officer, I will not. It's just very difficult with your interpretation, because it's a guilty plea. It makes it so difficult when you look at the various colloquy between the judge and Mr. Wilson.
And I think, Your Honor, that's exactly why McConnell was so very careful to lay out a number of statements by Mr. McConnell where he very clearly said it was premeditated murder. This is not that kind of a case, because if you go on further through the plea colloquy, it's very clear that Mr. Brennan is also saying, no, no, we are here to plead guilty only to a killing during the course of a robbery, and that is all. And he says it more than once.
Mr. Mitchell, again, I kind of took it the way Justice Cherry did. It sounded to me like he admitted to planning to kill the officer, not knowing it's an officer, but planning to kill, let's say, Mr. Hoff, and by the stabbing and all like that, and that was planned, and he didn't know he was a police officer, but he knew he was an individual, and they planned to kill him. Am I wrong? And
the way I read that, Your Honor, is that he pled guilty to planning the robbery. But if you look at how he explains what happened, the events that resulted in the death, he's saying, no, no, this was all self-defense. It would never have happened but for what Officer Hoff did. So I think the planning he's talking about is, yeah, we planned the robbery, but we didn't plan to kill this person. It happened as a result of the events during the course of the robbery, which, again, put it right back into McConnell.
Well, Counsel, I'm not so sure that's the case. The purpose of McConnell was to, as I understand it, as you know, I've written separately about this and disagree, but if one accepts McConnell as written, wasn't the purpose of McConnell to address a death penalty on a showing of felony murder where there'd been no intent to kill? Here, the record seems to adequately supply sufficient information demonstrating an intent to kill.
All right.
But on a broader picture, from a legal picture, you're going to ask us to look at every one of these guilty pleas and see if the colloquy contains enough or not enough to show intent to kill? Is that what you're asking us to do?
Well, I think what McConnell does is it says there has to be some bedrock foundational evidence that's fairly clear, soundly based on premeditation, to avoid the problem which McConnell identifies, which is this mixing of factual bases used to support capital punishment. And the abolishment or disintegration ways of this narrowing function that capital sentencing statutes are supposed to perform. And I think that disintegration of the narrowing function can occur whether it's a plea or whether it is a trial. The question really is, in the course of the hearing that results in the conviction, is there sufficient evidence to clearly show, soundly show, that the conviction is based on premeditation before we begin applying duplicated felony aggravators? That, I think, is the question. And if you go back and you compare McConnell with what happened in Wilson's plea colloquy, those two are night and day different. They are very different. Whereas McConnell is filled with evidence of premeditation, Wilson has very scant evidence. And if anything, it has the danger of that mixing that I think McConnell is trying to avoid. Your Honor, my time is up.
Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Mercer. We would thank both counsels for argument this day, clarifying what has transpired and what's before us. I was failed to note that Justice Pickering had indicated she had a conflict due to some prior involvement with this matter. With that, the matter will stand submitted.